You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the Milwaukee Bucks are in the Eastern Conference Finals for the first time since 2001. A sports writer gives us a preview of their matchup and the road to the championship. Now, the state Supreme Court heard oral arguments earlier today in the League of Women Voters versus Tony Evers. That's one of four legal challenges to last year's lame duck session where state Republicans rolled back the power of incoming Attorney General Josh Call and Governor Evers. Sean Johnson is WPR's Capitol Bureau Chief. He's been at the court covering the hearing today. Sean, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Rob.
Well, now there are a handful of lawsuits challenging what happened back in December in this lame duck session of the legislature. Remind us which one this is.
This is the one that is in state court that is strictly process-based. So this isn't talking about really separation of powers, or it's not saying it's not in federal court. This is one that's saying that the lame duck session violated the Wisconsin Constitution because the Wisconsin Constitution does not explicitly allow for what's known as an extraordinary session. Because of that, they said it's unlawful, and that the whole session, the laws passed, the appointments confirmed, should all be thrown out. They won in Dane County Circuit Court, but that ruling has been stayed by conservatives on the Supreme Court, and so that brought us to arguments here today.
And before we get into what went down today, just to untangle a weird wrinkle in this, this is League of Women Voters versus Tony Evers. He's technically the defendant, even though he wouldn't really want to defend what happened in December, I think, right?
I think at this point it's morphed, and that you have this more of an adversarial relationship where it's an attorney for the legislature, which got involved in this in a formal way, who is now kind of on the defense here, and in this situation, that attorney for the legislature is who's asking the Supreme Court to get in, step in, and reject the lower court's ruling.
So let's get into what we heard now. First, the arguments from both sides, and let's start with the League of Women Voters and other groups involved in this lawsuit. How did they argue their case that this thing didn't happen because it was unconstitutional?
They really keep pointing back to the text of the Constitution and then the text of the statutes, the text of the laws. And they say the Constitution does not mention extraordinary sessions, and it does not. The Constitution does talk about special sessions, which are called by governors, have been called by governors basically since Wisconsin became a state, but that extraordinary sessions are not in there. They point to the laws and say there's no law that spells out what an extraordinary session is. So in practice, extraordinary sessions have been called by committees of legislative leaders in Wisconsin for the past 40 years. There have been about two dozen of them in Wisconsin. They have happened, and there are bills that have passed, laws that have passed during those sessions that that people would know about. But there's nothing in state law or in the Constitution that explicitly says that there can be an extraordinary session. And so plaintiffs are saying, that's the argument. Stop right there. This can't happen.
And what was the argument from attorneys arguing on behalf of the legislature on the other side?
A couple things. They're saying that if the courts step in here and tell the legislature what to do, that is kind of an overstep by one branch of government onto another, that it's not the position, it should not be the position of the courts to step in and say that because the legislature didn't use the right word to describe its meeting, that the whole session was invalid. Their other argument is that the court has given the legislature broad leeway when it comes to its own process, its own schedule. And they actually point to a 2011 case, one of the cases that upheld Act 10, and they point to that as one of their examples. So that was an open meetings case. It was charged that the legislature violated the state's open meetings law when it passed Act 10. The Supreme Court at the time, which was still under a conservative majority, said that that wasn't a place for a judge to step in and make that decision, and that the legislature had broad leeway to decide its own proceedings.
We're talking to WPR Capitol Bureau Chief Sean Johnson. He was at Wisconsin State Supreme Court hearing oral arguments in a challenge to Wisconsin's lame duck legislative session and everything that came out of it last December. Sean, I know with a disclaimer that you can't necessarily read how a judge is going to vote based on the questioning that they do on a case. Let's look at what they had to say. First, the conservative majority, what kind of issues did we hear? What kind of statements did we hear from them?
I would say a couple of them sent pretty strong signals. So just as a reminder, there's a 4-3 conservative majority on the Wisconsin Supreme Court right now. So those are the justices who will decide this case. That majority will grow to 5-2 in August. But right now we have 4-3. We'll start with Justice Rebecca Bradley. So when it was time for the League of Women Voters attorney to get up there and make his argument, he, you know, stepped to the lectern. And before he could make his argument, Justice Bradley was there with a question. She said, you're asking this court to rule that the Wisconsin legislature has been acting unconstitutionally for over 4 decades. How can that be? Don't you find it extraordinary that nobody has raised this issue before this court in over 4 decades? So a skeptical tone there right from the get-go. If you want to read the tea leaves from Justice Daniel Kelly and other of the court's conservatives, I think there's a lot there to read. He was saying that the Constitution had given lawmakers and the governor power to decide when and how often the legislature should meet. He said that, quote, put in a great big potential door to hold sessions like these. And this is another quote. He says, quote, the statute allows for that. How do I get around that? So he is essentially stating that the law, in kind of an indirect way, but that the law lets the legislature set its schedule. And so that's the position he's starting from. So I don't think you have to read too much into where Justice Kelly was on this.
And then the liberal minority sounds like they were asking questions sympathetic to the League of Women Voters and their co-plaintiffs.
Yeah, I would say especially Justice Rebecca Bradley. She is the...
Ann Walsh Bradley.
Thank you. No, Ann Walsh Bradley was one chimed in there. Who we have a Rebecca Dallet and an Ann Walsh Bradley and Rebecca Bradley on the court now. So the names kind of blend together sometimes. Yeah, Justice Ann Walsh Bradley was saying, look, I've been around this building, and I know there are certain times of the year when it's... things are wrapping up and there's kind of a hurry to get things done. Are you telling me that that this schedule doesn't matter? Because one of the arguments, another argument from the Republican legislature on this is that the legislature is basically always in session. Whether they call it an extraordinary session or not, they're in session all the time. The other argument came from Rebecca Dallet, and she said, I think we need to focus on the text here. And she also said, look, if the legislature wants to meet an extraordinary session, they can do that. All they have to do is pass a law that creates extraordinary sessions. And they didn't do that in this case.
We'll leave it there for now, Sean, and watch for the results. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Rob.
That's Sean Johnson, WPR Capitol Bureau Chief, with us to talk about the first round of oral arguments on laws from last year's lame duck session. Those arguments happened earlier today at the state Supreme Court. Coming up, the Milwaukee Bucks are making their first trip to the NBA Eastern Conference Finals in nearly 2 decades. We'll preview tonight's Game 1 matchup against the Toronto Raptors and break down the Bucks' chances of going all the way. That's coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the Milwaukee Bucks open their best-of-7 series against the Toronto Raptors tonight for the right to play for the NBA championship. We'll talk about what the Bucks have to do in advance and learn about their opponent's strengths and hopefully weaknesses. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a Wisconsin company that makes tap handles. It's part of WPR's ongoing series exploring Wisconsin's complicated relationship with alcohol.
One thing people may not think of when it comes to Wisconsin's rich brewing history is a tap handle. That colorful, sometimes ornate handle bartenders push to pour a beer. Think Miller Lite, the Central Waters Heron, or the Liney Kugel's Canoe. There is a 32-year-old business in Random Lake that bills itself as the top producer of tap handles in the United States. WPR digital news editor Andrea Anderson toured AJS Tap Handles, where employees shaped, sanded, and painted the handcrafted tap handles.
I think it's the first thing that a customer sees when they come into a bar. And if they're looking for something different, a tap handle can tell, a tap handle can create that first beer for them, because they're going to, if they see something they like, yeah, they'll naturally go for it. It's proven. And so it's very important. It's your name, it's your brand, it's who you are. It's your first line of identity when someone comes into a bar. I'm Bob Zernjable, sales director at AJS Tap Handles. We are owned by Hank's Craft Incorporated. Our mission, our goal, is to make the best tap handles for everyone in the brewing industry. Whether it's tap handles made of wood, which we make 100% here, or urethane or metal, we work with a lot of breweries throughout the entire country and actually worldwide.
Oh, I take the parts and they're rough. If you feel them, they're sharp. And what I do is I smooth them out. That way the paint will stick to them. And it takes out any chips and things.
So it all starts with either a visit or otherwise a long conversation as to, you know, where they want to go with their handle, what they want to do. What does their handle represent for them? There are some breweries that are very large that the tap handles don't seem to be as important, but it's the smaller breweries that may be just starting, or the mid-sized breweries that handle means everything. A lot of workers out here that are making these by hand. The tap handles are all made by hand. They're painted by hand. Their decals are put on them by hand. The only machinery that we're really using is to shape and create the type of handle that you're looking for. After that, it's all by hand.
They make a special tool. So what it's doing is it's pushing it through that tool, and it's shaving that handle, creating that look that you're looking for.
So now we put the details on them, which would be the decals, the water slides, the medallions that you see on the top. Those all get put on in these stages over here. This is called the finishing area. Jackie over here, what are you doing, Jackie?
I'm putting water slides on spindle tap handles. When I started here 29 and a half years ago, I thought to myself, okay, it'll be a cool job for a while. How many tap handles can one person or one company make? Well, here I am now, almost 30 years later, and it's amazing the number of handles. And then when you go to a bar and you walk into a bar, and the first thing you do is instinctively look at the tap handles. And you sit there and go, I made that, we made that, we made that. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And then the bartender looks at you and you're like, well, I work at a place that makes them.
And they go, what?
Yeah.
That story came to us from WPR's Andrea Anderson. It's part of WPR's project High Tolerance, a deep dive into Wisconsin's relationship with alcohol. To hear all the stories, go to WPR.org/alcohol. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, the Milwaukee Bucks resume their march toward an NBA title tonight. They'll host the Toronto Raptors at Fiserv Forum in Game 1 of the Eastern Conference Finals. After the Bucks took a 3-1 lead over the Boston Celtics in the previous round, NBA Hall of Famer Charles Barkley made a bold prediction live on national TV.
The Milwaukee Bucks are going to win the world championship.
Oh, wow.
Wait.
They're going to win it all.
The Bucks haven't gotten this far in 18 years. Their only championship came in 1971 when they were led by Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and Oscar Robertson. So what's it going to take for the Bucks to get past the Raptors? Matt Velasquez is the Bucks beat reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He talked to Central Time producer Bill Martins.
The Bucks finished with the league's best record during the regular season at 60-22. Toronto had the second best mark, 58-24. They were pretty much on the Bucks' heels all season long. How difficult a series do you think this might be?
Well, I think it'll be a pretty close series. You know, they match up really well with one another. Every game that they played, at least the
ones that both Giannis Antetokounmpo and Kawhi Leonard played in, those games were closed into the fourth quarter. So I think that, you know, going off of those, obviously, take them with a grain of salt. There's no Nikola Mirotic for the Bucks in those games, no Marc Gasol for the Raptors in those games. You know, but generally speaking, like, these teams have been two of the best teams in the NBA all season long. You know, really potent offenses, really strong defenses, but both of them really hang their hat on the defensive end. And so I expect this series to be fun and close and exciting.
So the Bucks have had about the past week or so off. They took care of Boston in five games. Toronto took them seven games to get past the Sixers. So which team has the advantage heading into Game 1 tonight?
You know, I think it would probably be the Bucks. They have the home court advantage. They do have the rest. They're able to get Malcolm Brogdon another week of rest and recovery, and maybe shaking off the rust a little bit in practice situations. So just being able to have all of that going for them. The Raptors had to play a really knockdown, drag out seven game series against the 76ers. Kyle Lowry has a lingering thumb issue that he was able to play through. There's a little bit more beat up, a little bit shorter bench. And so being at home, I would favor the Bucks.
Before we talk more about the Bucks, let's talk about the Raptors for a second. They're led by Kawhi Leonard. I've heard some analysts suggest that if anybody in the East is better than Giannis Antetokounmpo, it's Kawhi. So what makes him so good?
I mean, he can really just score anywhere on the court. He's a terrific scorer in the paint, three-point range. He's excellent in the mid-range. He's really comfortable in the mid-range. Then you also look at his defense, and he's a two-time NBA Defensive Player of the Year. He's got huge hands, a long wingspan, just a really good idea of where he needs to be and a knack for getting in passing lanes and breaking things up. He's just like almost in a vacuum at that end. He just totally sucks everything into himself, and he can defend basically any position at his size. He's about 6'7", 6'8", so at his size, he can defend basically anybody. I mean, if you're trying to create an ideal – basketball player in a lab, but you're looking at somebody similar to Kawhi Leonard.
And that's going to be Chris Middleton, who's going to be guarding him for the most part tonight for the Bucks, right? You wrote about that, I think, in today's Journal Sentinel. Tell us about how that matchup went during the regular season.
Yeah, so Chris Middleton, out of the, and this is according to the NBA's tracking data, their matchup data, which isn't always perfect. But in general, Kawhi had 223 possessions against the Bucks this year, and Chris Middleton guarded him for 143 of those, or at least was tracked as the defender for 143 of those, which is, most of the possessions, about 64%. And Kawhi scored, I believe it was 36 points on 11 of 27 shooting, made like 11 free throws. The Raptors' offense was generally pretty good during those stretches, but Kawhi wasn't the one doing the bulk of the damage. That's a credit to Chris Middleton, his ability to fight over screens and deny the ball and make things tough on Kawhi, or at least tougher. He's the kind of player where, you can't stop him. He's going to get his points. He's going to get his shots. He's going to take contested shots, and they're going to go down. So all you can do is really just try to make things tough. And that's something that Middleton's done. And obviously he knows that he has a lot of help behind him. Guys like Giannis Antetokounmpo and Brook Lopez are waiting, ready to pounce, ready to double. If Kawhi gets into the lane, they're really trying to stop him from getting to the hoop, and they'd rather take their chances with Kawhi putting up, contested mid-range shots, hopefully contested by more than one guy. So it'll be interesting to see how Middleton handles that, and it should be another fun matchup in this fun series.
We're talking with Matt Velasquez, Bucks beat reporter with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We're previewing the Eastern Conference Finals between the Bucks and the Toronto Raptors. Giannis Antetokounmpo, probably pretty safe to say he's going to be the league's MVP. Are the Raptors a team that could give him some trouble, or might he be in for a big series?
Yeah, the Raptors are a team that they have the weapons, they have the players that they can throw at him, that can make him work. I think he's still going to have a big series just because that's how he's wired, that's how he's built, that's what he does. But they have somebody like Pascal Siakam, who has similar size and length and athleticism. He's not at Giannis's level by any means, but he's similarly built and is able to offer some resistance there in the paint. Marc Gasol is a former Defensive Player of the Year. Obviously, that was about 7 years ago, but he's still a strong, solid, high IQ defensive player who can make things tough on Giannis. And then Kawhi, he might be giving up some size, but as I mentioned before, he's just a fantastic defensive player. And if there are situations where he gets matched up on Giannis, then you know, it's going to be a little bit tougher than your average when it comes to dealing with him. So, you know, then there's also the possibility of OG Anunoby, who had an emergency appendectomy right at the end of the regular season. He might be able to come back for this series, and he'd be another long, athletic, versatile guy who they could throw at Giannis. So I think they have a bunch of guys they can throw at him. It's just a matter of how long it takes for Giannis to figure out that defense and then how he can exploit it.
Over in the Western Conference Finals, we've got the Golden State Warriors, the Portland Trail Blazers. Golden State won last night without too much difficulty to take a 1-0 series lead. If you're a Bucks fan, who are you pulling for in that one?
I think if you're a Bucks fan, if you are expecting the Bucks to make it to the finals, you'd probably be calling for Portland. I think that they are the worst of the two options in terms of quality. I mean, the Warriors are the cream of the NBA. They don't even have Kevin Durant last night, and they put that kind of game on the Blazers. And when they get him back, I mean, he's a multi-time Finals MVP, NBA MVP, arguably the best player in the league right now. If you want to make that argument, I don't think that you'd be crazy. So, you know, I think the Warriors will pose the much tougher test. I think the Warriors will win. I would expect them to win in five in that series and make their way to the finals yet again.
Okay. Now, as we wrap up, do you agree with Sir Charles's prediction that the Bucks are going to win the whole thing?
I don't know if I'd be so bold as Sir Charles. I think that's his thing, is making bold proclamations and predictions. I would go as far as to say I think the Bucks will get to the finals. I just wrote for the paper. It'll probably be on JS Online later today, sometime on Wednesday. But I think the Bucks will win in six. That's gonna be my official prediction for the series. But once you get to the finals, it's a much tougher situation. Especially if you're dealing with the Warriors.
Yeah, they've been there before, and it's been a long time since the Bucks have, but we'll see what happens. Matt, thanks very much for joining us today. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Matt Velazquez is the Bucks beat reporter for the Milwaukee Journal-Sentinel. He talked to Bill Martins about the NBA's Eastern Conference Finals matchup between the Bucks and the Toronto Raptors. Game one in the best-of-seven series tips off tonight in Milwaukee. Coming up, our guest says cutting down carbon emissions isn't enough. We need to start adapting to life under global warming conditions. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. Earlier this week, the nonprofit environmental disclosure group CDP came out with its first-of-a-kind ranking of cities working actively to combat climate change. New York, San Francisco, Boston, and Toronto received some of the highest scores out of nearly 600 cities worldwide for their actions on cutting emissions and crafting climate strategies. Our next guest says cutting emissions is only part of the story when it comes to dealing with the future of climate change. He's calling for Plan B, figuring out how to adapt to a changing environment. Roger Sejo is a senior fellow emeritus at the group Resources for the Future and the director of their Forest Economics and Policy Program. He's a shared recipient of the Nobel Peace Prize for his work on the IPCC Climate Report, and he's the author of the new book, Surviving Global Warming, Why Eliminating Greenhouse Gases Isn't Enough. Roger, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
Well, you write that a lot of the focus, almost all the focus when it comes to global warming and climate change is in cutting greenhouse gas emissions. And you say that alone just isn't enough. Why is that?
Well, the point I developed in the book is the fact that even though the global community is striving to reduce greenhouse gases, their success is only questionable. We've tried to slam on the greenhouse gas brakes, if you will, but we haven't been very successful. And so if you look at the increase of greenhouse gases coming down the pike from various human activities, it's overwhelming our attempts to try to control it. So since the mitigation approach, stopping the greenhouse gas approach, is not being fully successful, we have suggested a Plan B, which stresses adaptation as a backup to, not an alternative for, but a backup to the current activities.
Right. I think sometimes the idea of saying, okay, we need to adapt to a reality of a warming world, sometimes people hear that and say, wait, so you're giving up? We're not going to try to mitigate it? You're saying a little from column A, a little from column B, it sounds like.
Well, we're saying continue column A just as we have, but we're just realistic here in the fact that it is not doing the job. It is not adequate. The mitigation activities are not adequate to stop the buildup of greenhouse gases and to control climate change, climate warming. So not a substitute for, but we're proposing a backup to. So we would have two kinds of activities addressing the climate change issue. One of those would be the addition of what I call adaptation.
Before we get to particular adaptations, you look back at the history of Earth's climate and point out that there are natural eras of climate change well before we had this boost in carbon emissions. We may be adding to that now. But are there lessons in how to adapt to our current climate change based on what we've seen in the past?
Well, one of the points of that discussion, looking at even in historic times, we've had situations of substantial global warming. And we also have, from scientific assessments of glaciers and what have you, additional evidence that we've had earlier global warming. And it's not related to greenhouse gases. So the whole warming phenomenon is multi-causal by activities both related to greenhouse gases, but obviously other activities, because we have examples of warming without the rise in greenhouse gases.
Talking to Roger Sajo about his new book, Surviving Global Warming, Why Eliminating Greenhouse Gases Isn't Enough. Let's get into some of the adaptations you're watching for, some of the things that'll change in a warming world. I'll start with one close to home here in Wisconsin. Roger, you write about agriculture. What kind of adaptations do you see needed in the world of farming?
Well, there are a variety of kinds of things that can be done. I mean, one of the most obvious is a change in the nature of the crop. If you have a warming and a drying, you might need to shift out of corn, for example, into one of the other grains, perhaps wheat, that is more successfully grown in a drier and warmer climate. Or in addition to changing the crop as such, you might even have to go to additional lands that were good for one purpose and not so good for the other in the climate of the time, and make the kind of adjustments. Basically, it's adaptation by using a changing crop or changing the provenance of the crop that you're using, basically making adjustments on land use in the agricultural sector. Also, you have the possibility now of breeding different kinds of characteristics into the seeds that are used for growing the crop. So that would be something that plant breeders could be involved in. And of course, they're doing things right now, but particularly with an eye toward the changing climate conditions and crops that would tend to be able to thrive in those new conditions under whatever the climate regime turns out to be.
One concern from some agricultural researchers I've talked to, Roger, is that, okay, yes, if there's a steady gradual increase from year to year, we can make that kind of change. But one problem might be the unpredictable things, an early warm and a late frost working together to ruin a crop, or a couple back-to-back years of flooding or back-to-back years of drought. Do you have thoughts on how to adapt to those more unpredictable extremes that might be more likely under climate change?
Yeah, well, that is an issue. We're moving into an area where we don't have experience, and so it would require a lot of alternatives. One approach might be to have a broader array of crops in a field, have perhaps smaller fields, but of different types of crops. So if it turns out to be particularly dry, some subset of your cropping can respond positively to that. One of the things about anticipated climate change is, although there's concern about drought and dryness, one of the expectations of a warmer climate is that we may have more precipitation. It may come, however, in the form of large downpours rather than gradual occasional rains. So there are obviously uncertainties here, and part of it is to recognize that there are uncertainties and make, if you will, small adjustments and adaptations and some sorts of, if you will, almost strategies in terms of dealing with a climate that you're not quite sure which direction it's going to move in. But I think the main thing is to be resilient here and opportunistic in terms of thinking ahead and plant managing your agricultural activities with the recognition of these climate change forces.
Talking to Roger Sajo from the think tank Resources for the Future. His new book is Surviving Global Warming While Eliminating Greenhouse Gases Isn't Enough. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want political leaders to do when it comes to trying to offset or adapt to climate change? And in your community, what do you think about, what do you worry about when it comes to the potential impacts of global warming? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our look at climate change and how humans might adapt to a warmer world. Roger Sajo is with us. His new book is Surviving Global Warming, Why Eliminating Greenhouse Gases Isn't Enough. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you worry about when it comes to the possible impacts of climate change? How do you want to see Wisconsin, the nation, the world try to adapt to changing conditions? Do you have a question for our guest? Call 800-642-1234. Roger, we just talked about agriculture. In your book, you cover a lot of issues, how to deal with rising sea levels for one, biodiversity, others. But in general, do you feel like there's enough attention being paid to the adaptation side of the equation when it comes to global warming?
Well, one of the purposes for writing the book was I did not think that that aspect of a response to climate change was being adequately dealt with. I do notice, however, that there seems to be more and more attention given to adaptation. I have sort of two dimensions or two facets that I stress on the adaptation. One is the one that we just discussed, where we're talking about different kinds of management or adjusting our management, whether it's of our agriculture or whether it's of our seashores, where those areas are concerned about sea level rise. There are ways to anticipate and make adjustments for that. Basically, what we're trying to do is minimize the damages that would be associated with climate change. So that's one aspect of adaptation. Another aspect of adaptation would be to make adjustments to respond to the increase in greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. The traditional approach here that is being used is mitigation to try to get rid of those. The other one is to acknowledge that they are building up in the atmosphere and they are causing warming, and ask ourselves, are there things we can do to the atmosphere to change it enough to make it more, if you will, reflective in this case? Can we make changes in that atmosphere by adding different kinds of components to it? we know that after volcanoes, after large volcanoes, the whole climate of the Earth regularly cools for a couple or 3 years. And this is due to aerosols that the volcanic activity frees into the atmosphere. Now, this kind of thing can be mimicked. And there's a group at Harvard who's working on what kinds of aerosols could humans introduce in the atmosphere to change the reflectivity of the atmosphere and stratosphere enough to offset some of the warming that's occurred. There are other approaches being undertaken. The University of Washington is looking at the possibility of whitening of clouds. If we can make clouds whiter, more reflective, that could help in terms of offsetting some of the warming effects of the greenhouse gases. So there are a lot of other dimensions here that could be added to this, quote, fight against warming. And what I'm suggesting, and I think what's being now looked at in, with increasing effort, is the is some of those adaptative changes that would allow humans, together with the mitigation, to more successfully resist and adapt to any climate changes that would be forthcoming.
I want to bring on a caller now. Carl is with us in La Crosse. Carl, hi.
Good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. You know, I see that although we have, you hear that our cities are getting more populated, I feel like we're also getting a lot more suburban growth, which is putting a greater demand on just our transportation use and basically creating in the way that we live a higher need for, you know, more miles per day to be driven. And I just wonder, is there a way that we can reduce the footprint that we're creating by basically living closer to where we work and trying to be a little bit more aware of our daily transportation use?
Carl, thanks for the call. Designing our way in part out of the problems. Roger, in our last couple of minutes, do you have thoughts on that?
Well, of course, there are different ways of doing that. One is to try to develop vehicles that do not release greenhouse gases or release fewer greenhouse gases. And we're talking about electric cars here or other non-fossil fuel-driven approaches to transport. The other dimension of this is to change the configuration of our living areas so we have more centers of population that are close to the areas where they're working and what have you. That certainly makes sense, and I think there are attempts to try to do both of those. I think it's most obvious in terms of the movement toward electrical vehicles for transport, and you do see attempts to develop clusters of population within cities and to move out of the suburban kind of approach. So I think that those are all sensible kinds of things to do and moving in the right direction. And basically, my view is there's no silver bullet to this entire global warming problem. We're not going to solve it with one or two master strokes. Rather, there are going to be a whole lot of small activities that in concert collectively will have an effect and allow us both to mitigate the buildup of temperature.
And that's a good place to leave it. Thanks to Roger Sajo. His new book is Surviving Global Warming: Why Eliminating Greenhouse Gases Isn't Enough. The laws that regulate alcohol in Wisconsin are complicated and confusing, partly because they've been filled with exceptions and protections for industries and business over the course of decades. That's created an often adversarial relationship between members of the alcohol lobby at the state capitol. In our continuing series, High Tolerance, Sean Johnson has this report on the politics of alcohol and how it's changing.
In 2011, Republican State Senator Alberta Darling introduced a sweeping proposal to rewrite beer distribution laws. 6 minutes later, she asked for a vote. It was during deliberations of the legislature's budget committee. Democratic Senator Bob Jauch stopped the roll call, still unsure of what was in the motion.
It is a little difficult when you have a nine-page document that didn't come up at any of the public hearings. But then it wouldn't be a budget without having something to do with liquor wholesalers or beer wholesalers. And it is every budget.
It's Wisconsin.
The measure was being pushed by Wisconsin's beer distributors and Miller Coors. They said it would keep Anheuser-Busch from buying up beer distributors. Small brewers wanted that power for themselves, but they weren't there to protest. And after a few minutes of discussion, the measure passed on a bipartisan vote. Longtime alcohol regulator Roger Johnson saw votes like these over and over again during his nearly four decades at the Wisconsin Department of Revenue.
I think the thing that comes to mind is that old saying I would have is that, if we can't feather our own nest, let's fence in the competition. And that's kind of the way it was.
Before he retired in 2014, Johnson was known in the industry as the state's point person for explaining what the alcohol laws actually meant and how they'd be enforced. The constant fighting among different factions of the industry reminded Johnson of the All-Star Wrestling show he watched as a kid, when 25 wrestlers would enter the ring and only one would emerge.
We were, in my role, kind of the referee in that battle royal.
One of the heavy hitters in that battle is the state's distributor lobby, the businesses that deliver Wisconsin's beer, wine, and liquor. According to a review by the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign, distributors have given Wisconsin political candidates about $3.3 million over the past 20 years. Wisconsin Democracy Campaign Director Matt Rothschild says that puts them in the top 5% of all special interest donors.
They know how to play the power game. So if Democrats are in power, they're going to give more money to Democrats. If Republicans are in power, they're going to give more money to Republicans.
Another major player at the Capitol is the Tavern League of Wisconsin. Rhinelander Republican Assemblyman Rob Swearingen led the group before he was elected in 2012. He says the power of the Tavern League is in its 5,000 members.
Because every one of these lawmakers has a tavern in their backyard, or a supper club, or a reception hall, or somebody that's got a liquor license.
It used to be that when the Tavern League and the distributors teamed up, they'd usually get what they want. But that hasn't been the case recently. The two groups have been frustrated with inconsistent enforcement of liquor laws by the Department of Revenue since Roger Johnson left. They supported plans to step up enforcement by creating a so-called alcohol czar and by regulating wedding barns that allow unlicensed alcohol sales. But both efforts were blocked by a new coalition that included free market conservative groups like Americans for Prosperity and the craft beverage industry. Jeffrey Glazer is an attorney who represents craft brewers. He says that as they've spread all over the state, they've gained grassroots power too.
Because almost every single state representative and certainly every single state senator has a brewery in their district. And those breweries are very popular.
Isaac Shawaki, who started Octopi Brewing in Wanakee in 2014, says smaller businesses have come into their own since that 2011 budget.
You know, as brewers, we're small, we're scrappy, and we tended to be disorganized. I don't think we're disorganized anymore.
Some members of the alcohol industry downplay the conflict. They say brewers, distributors, and tavern owners can work together at the Capitol. But if they're passing fewer big bills these days, it could be because the battle royale over alcohol laws is no longer such a lopsided fight. Sean Johnson, Wisconsin Public Radio.
You can read more about this story and see the rest of our series, High Tolerance, at WPR.org/alcohol. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, there are new plans for the U.S. to put people on the moon and calls for a military department in charge of operations in orbit. We'll round up the latest news in space. And if you want to raise successful kids, relax. That's the lesson from the author of How to Raise Successful People. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.